In this session, we'll be talking about a number of things. I'd like to start off with a brief summary of some of the sessions that we've had this week on Mexico and Central America. Sort of a review for those that have caught some of those, perhaps a little bit of a laying of some groundwork for those of you that have not had a chance to be here for those. I think it will set the context of this session by doing that. Then I'd like to talk about faith responses of persons in Central America to that situation. I'd like to talk then a bit about faith responses of persons in North America to that situation. Then I would like to, or we would like to, speak about a covenant that has been developed between Central American and United States Christians, a covenant which expresses intent to act in faith responses regarding that situation. Pat Hayden has agreed to present that for us tonight, so she is a co-participant. Then following that, we will have an open discussion, and I hope we will all then be co-participants in this discussion, and that we will have a chance then to discuss faith responses to the situation in that place. Just a word or two about myself to set a little bit more of the context. I am an engineer by profession, an electrical engineer. I have an engineering business in Minneapolis. I'm the chairperson of the Center for Global Service and Education Advisory Board. It's a center associated with Augsburg College. Its present role is to primarily serve to sponsor study seminars to Central America and other third world countries, but primarily Central America, for the purpose of raising awarenesses with regard to things that are taking place in those places. The center also sponsors conferences to similarly raise awarenesses. It was through this center that I did go to Central America last year, visited Mexico and Nicaragua, spent a considerable amount of time talking to people in those places and trying to spend time getting various viewpoints from those persons, many of whom who have been in the struggle of the oppression and with the poor in those countries. Pat returned in June from a similar trip to Mexico, Honduras, and Nicaragua, and so she has perhaps a little fresher perspective on that, but I would say highly consistent. When we compare notes there's a very consistent pattern. That tends to be the case as we have had a chance to talk to hundreds of people, 1 to 200 people anyway, over the past year who have visited there. We seem to get a very consistent story of some of the things that are taking place. Faith responses. Let's do just a very quick description of what we mean by that. For the purposes of this session anyway, let's define faith responses as responses born out of faith in Jesus Christ and the call to follow him. Responses born out of faith in Jesus Christ and the call to follow him. Now some words about faith responses of persons in Central America. And I might use, I might say that I'm going to talk not only of Central America, but to the extent that it applies throughout the entire Latin American area, I will maybe from time to time use the terminology Latin America where it applies to everything south of the southern border of the United States down to the tip of South America. There has been an almost miraculous change in sectors of the Catholic Church in Latin America. From its earliest history in Latin America, the Catholic Church identified with the military regimes, with the elite, wealthy, and the oligarchies of Latin America. The Catholic Church has, for the most part, since its earliest history in that place, that is the early 1500s, since the conquest in about 1520, have for the most part been identified with the elite, the military. It began to change in the early 1960s, at the time of Vatican II. Changes in the church in Latin America at that time were profound. The church I guess I should say at least a significant number of persons within the church spoke for the need for social change and economic change. These concerns for the poor and oppressed began to take the form of new theological modes, and we started to hear such things as theology of liberation from Latin America, theology of revolution, theology of hope. And this happened at a time when Latin America was hit by another wave of military dictatorships. You may recall that. We've seemed to now in the last decade or two decades primarily, had what seems to be a rash of military dictatorships in Central and Latin America. This change also led to the formation of the base Christian communities, which have engaged Christians in Latin America in a process of examination of their realization, or it has brought them to a realization, I should say, of the right to dignity as creations of that are created in the image of God. That is, the poor and oppressed of Latin America, as a result of some of these changes that have been taking place there, are starting to realize that they have a right to dignity as creations created in the image of God. The faith responses to the suffering of the poor in Latin America has been costly to some. The list of religious martyrs in Latin America grows. This list is perhaps exemplified by the death of San Salvador's Archbishop Oscar Romero, who was gunned down as he was saying Mass in a chapel in San Salvador in 1980. The church in Latin America has not totally changed, however, and there continues to be strife within it. Nonetheless, the change in the church, which I've just given you a very, very summary review of, has been significant. That change, as I've mentioned, has been a change toward a stronger identification with the struggles of the poor and oppressed, and it seems to be a miraculous change. Perhaps it's so miraculous because it has resulted in so many acts of faith, so many cases where people have been involved with the real struggles of persons there. Just some words now about faith responses of North American Christians to what has happened or the situation in Central America. Many North American Christians have joined and identified with the poor and suffering in Latin America. We have talked about a few of those this last week, and you'll recall some of those names: Pat Edmiston, Mary Hartman, Peter Marchetti, Justinian Leibel, Pat Hines. All of these people are presently serving in Nicaragua. They're North American Christians, marvelous people. One just wants to hug them. The impression that Nicaraguans have of the American people is greatly focused in these people that are serving there. And there are many, many more North Americans who have served in Latin America, and some who have died. We know of them, the three nuns and the lay worker in El Salvador that were murdered, and there are others. In addition to that, many North American Christians have attempted to learn more about what is happening there. Christians have attempted in the United States to identify, to be in solidarity with people in Latin America that are struggling. That has happened in many ways. We'll talk a little bit about that perhaps as we talk about faith responses a little bit later. I want to talk just for a minute or two about some of the barriers that we Christians in the United States have experienced as we have attempted to act out our faith in the Central American situation. Maybe you have experienced this as well, some of these things anyway. Just a word or two about some of these. And I have about three points here. First of all, we have a tendency in our country, perhaps worldwide, toward despair over the almost seeming hopelessness of the situation, particularly as we see the Central American situation as an east-west, black-white sort of thing. It almost seems like the east-west struggle is an insurmountable one. So we tend toward despair. about it. I wanted to read just a thing or two in The Feast of Life by John Polton, this being sort of the theme book for Holden this summer, which speaks to this issue of despair, and he sort of, I think, places us in the right spot with these words. The 70s and 80s, on the other hand, with their defeatist gloom, have cast a spell of generally pessimistic fatalism over the world. If the heresy of the earlier mood was, there's nothing we need to do, the heresy now is, there is nothing we can do. Applying both these forms of fatalism to life as a whole or the world as a whole leads either to a cosmic complacency or a cosmic despondency. A Christian point of view rejects both of these. Because God is in control, there is no room for despair or nervousness. Because he has called us to work with him, there is no room for withdrawal or resignation. The biblical truth is that human responsibility and choices are awesomely real. We have been made only a little lower than the angels and given the power to make or break our world. When our eyes are open to see them, the evidences of renewal and of new birth are all around us. Our own choices can put us alongside the risen Lord of life, whose purposes everywhere are to make all things new. A good statement regarding this tendency that we have toward despair. Another barrier we tend to have against acting out our faith in Central America, and I would say perhaps in all the struggling areas of the world, is that we have a difficult time acknowledging complicity in some of the oppression that is taking place. I think we're culturally conditioned in our society here to have a tough time with that. We've talked this week about some of the injustices and oppressions that exist in Central America and Mexico, and have identified to a certain extent the connections between that suffering and some of the affluence that we experience in this society. And the connections are fairly clear. And yet we do have a tough time. I'm sure all of us experience this. We have a tough time acknowledging that complicity. Third, another barrier, I think, toward a barrier to us acting out faith responses in this situation is that we see the struggle in Latin America, and more specifically in Central America, as a political issue. And we generally consider our matters of faith apolitical. That is, not to be in the political domain. My experience after coming back from Central America and talking about the situation in Nicaragua in my church has been essentially, don't talk about what's happening in Nicaragua here. That is a political issue and is not appropriately dealt with in church. That's maybe simplifying the statement, but in essence, that sort of tendency is one that I think we have held in our church. I was struck this morning at the Bible study lesson that Joan Conrad conducted. It's the one in Matthew 25 where Jesus said, I was hungry and you fed me. It struck me at that point that it's a political act in Central America to feed someone who is hungry. A political act. And in some cases, people have died for it. And similarly, I was naked and you clothed me. It's a political act in Central America to help clothe the poor people of that place. It's a political act, and people have died for that. I was in prison and you visited me. It's a political act in Central America, clearly, to visit imprisoned in cases, and people have died for it. So I recall so vividly Gerardo Thiessen in Mexico saying, in response to this kind of discussion, this kind of issue, love always has political implications. He didn't say sometimes or occasionally or frequently. He said always. Love always has political implications. And I think we need to consider that. It isn't in our nature to do that, but I think we need to take another look. We need to look through different glasses at that particular issue in our church. I'd like to read for you just a short segment from Dom Helder Camara's book, The Desert is Fertile. He is and has been the Archbishop of Recife and Olinda in northeast Brazil, one of the most poor regions in the world, I believe, and has been one of the strong advocates of the poor in Latin America. This little section is entitled God's Voice Today, and I think it speaks to us about acting out our faith in this situation of struggle and oppression that seems to be so prevalent in Central America. God's Voice Today. We are told that Abraham and other patriarchs heard the voice of God. Can we also hear the Lord's call? Isn't it pretentious to say this, dangerously presumptuous? We live in a world where millions of our fellow men and women live in inhuman conditions, practically in slavery. If we are not deaf, we hear the cries of the oppressed. Their cries are the voice of God. We who live in rich countries where there are always pockets of underdevelopment and wretchedness, hear if we want to hear the unvoiced demands of those who have no voice and no hope. The pleas of those who have no voice and no hope are the voice of God. Anyone who has become aware of the injustices caused by the unfair divisions of wealth must, if he or she has a heart, listen to the silent or violent protests of the poor. The protests of the poor are the voice of God. If we look at the relations between the poor countries and the capitalist and communist empires, we see that today injustice is not only done by one person to another, or by one group to another, but by one country to another. And the voice of the countries suffering these injustices is the voice of God. In order to rouse us, God makes use even of radical and violent rebellion. How can we not feel the urgent need to act when we see young people sincere in their desire to fight injustice, but with violent means which only call down violent repression, show such courage in prison and under torture that it is difficult to believe that they are sustained only by materialist ideals. He who has eyes to see and ears to hear must feel challenged. How can we remain mediocre and ineffective when we have our faith to sustain us? Are we so deaf that we do not hear a loving God warning us that humanity is in danger of committing suicide? Are we so selfish that we do not hear the just God demanding that we do all we can to stop injustice suffocating the world and driving it to war? Are we so alienated that we can worship God at our ease in luxurious temples, which are often empty in spite of all their liturgical pomp, and fail to see and hear and serve God where He is present and where He requires our presence? Among mankind, the poor, the oppressed, the victims of injustices in which we ourselves are often involved. It is not difficult to hear God's call today in the world about us. It is difficult to do more than offer an emotional response, sorrow and regret. It is even more difficult to give up our comfort, break with old habits, let ourselves be moved by grace, and change our lives. And he closes with a poem entitled, Come Lord, and it goes as follows, Come Lord. Do not smile and say you are already with us. Millions do not know you, and to us who do, what is the difference? What is the point of your presence if our lives do not alter? Change our lives, shatter our complacency. Make your word flesh of our flesh, blood of our blood, and our life's purpose. Take away the quietness of a clear conscience. Press us uncomfortably, for only thus that other peace is made, your peace. He's one of my favorites. A covenant between Christians from Central and America has been made. It's a covenant developed at the 6th Assembly of the World Council of Churches held in Vancouver this summer. And we see in this covenant, I think, a number of responses of faith to the situation specifically in Central America. And I think it should provide us with a good launching point for a discussion on what some of our personal responses of faith might be to that situation in Central America. And so I think at this point, let's hear about that. Pat, did you do that? And while you're doing that, I'll make any notes that you wish me to.
Thank you, Dick, very much. I was privileged to be an accredited visitor at the 6th Assembly of the World Council of Churches, which met in Vancouver, British Columbia, from the 24th of July of this year through the 10th of August. This was a gathering of some 3,500 Christians from 300 churches all around the world to meet and talk and worship and work together under the theme, Jesus Christ, the Life of the World. One of the things that happened early on in the life of the assembly were regional caucuses. All of the churches who came to Vancouver from the United States came together in a meeting. All of the delegates, all the advisors, all the accredited visitors, all of the staff who were working for the World Council from the United States came together. And there were about 350 of us in that room meeting all together. At the same time we were meeting, the representatives from the churches in Central and Latin America came together in their regional caucus. What we discovered after we had met that night individually was that the situation in Central America was the number one priority topic for all of us. It was the thing that we discussed, the effect of U.S. foreign policy in that region, the economic and social troubles and struggles that were going on were of primary concern both to the U.S. representatives there and also to the Central American representatives. I don't know who it was that suggested that perhaps we should have a meeting together. And there was such a meeting held of all the representatives of the two different regions of the world. And out of this meeting and the discussion that was held on Central America came the idea of a covenant that all of the people at Vancouver from these two regions of the world would consider signing. There was a committee drawn from the U.S. church representatives, churches representatives, and from the Latin American churches representatives to work to draw up this covenant. A meeting was held early on a Sunday morning before any of the other activities of the assembly began to read the draft of the covenant, both in English and in Spanish, to get the reaction of the people. There were lots of lively suggestions made about how the covenant should be revamped, and the committee went back to work. And within another 2 days, they came again with a draft, which all of us said, yes, this was what we would like to add our signatures to. And so one noon after the morning sessions were over, out in the middle of this beautiful meadow, which is a part of the University of British Columbia campus, everyone from Central America and the United States who wished to signed this covenant. I have a copy of the covenant here in English, and I would like to read it to you so that it can be part of our discussion. The first page is background, which may say a little bit more about what we did at the World Council, and the second page is the covenant itself. We Christians from Central America and the United States of America, church leaders, clergy, and lay persons, have joined together in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, in the 6th Assembly of the World Council of Churches, to reaffirm our common faith in Jesus Christ, the life of the world, and to give public witness to our unity, one with another, in the body, one body of Christ. We are alarmed and oppose the escalation of U.S. military engagement in Central America and the Caribbean, which has been ordered by President Reagan. We protest the decision to increase United States troops' presence in Honduras, to increase military aid to the present government of El Salvador, and deployment of naval forces off these shores. We, as U.S. participants, have sent a message of protest to President Reagan stating, quote, We urgently protest your decisions to increase U.S. troop presence in Honduras, to threaten further Nicaragua through the massive deployment of naval forces off its shores, and your refusal to practice to pursue friendly offers of peaceful negotiation of the Central America conflict. As believers in Jesus Christ, the life of the world, and as citizens and church leaders from the USA, we demand the immediate withdrawal of U.S. forces from the region, the cessation of all overt or covert efforts to destabilize or overthrow the legitimate government of Nicaragua, and the replacement of threats to use force with honest engagement in efforts to achieve a negotiated settlement for the conflicts now raging in Central America, which respect the sovereignty of the nations involved and the dignity and well-being of their peoples. Copies of this message are being communicated to members of Congress. This telegram was the result of our first caucus as U.S. people, and everyone who wished to signed the telegram, and it was sent. It happened on the day before the Senate was to take its vote on covert aid, financing covert aid to the Central American situation. The Central American participants said this: "We as Central American participants and our churches have been engaged beyond protest in ministries of service, reconciliation, and peacemaking for the peoples of our region. At the 6th World Assembly of the World Council of Churches, we have raised the level of awareness of the urgency for Christians to seek peace and justice in Central America. We have repeatedly called on U.S. Christians and concerned peoples to support the peace initiatives coming from the Nicaragua government and the people of El Salvador, and to support the Contadora Group, which has representatives of Mexico, Panama, Venezuela, and Colombia, seeking a political solution to the conflicts occurring in our countries. We have called upon all concerned Christians to urge the cessation of covert and overt operations and to stop intervention by the United States in the self-determination of our nations. We affirm Jesus Christ as the life of the world and seek to incarnate him in our region. We as Central American Christians are sharing with our United States brothers and sisters a new possibility of making real our commitment for life of the world. Conscious and vigorous attempts are being made by those in positions of power and influence to divide us into warring enemy camps, separating U.S. and Central American Christians one from another, and driving wedges between and within our churches. Here we reaffirm in the strongest possible terms that we shall not be divided. We are one in Christ, and there is nothing, neither tribulation, nor distress, nor persecution, nor famine, nor nakedness, nor peril, nor sword, which can separate us from his love. As a sign of our unity, an expression of our common faith and our love of Christ, the Prince of Peace, the bringer of justice and the life of the world, we hereby covenant together in the presence of Christ and Christians and churches from the whole world, and as a witness to all." And these are the things that we covenant to do together: to remain united in prayer and active solidarity at all costs. To remain in constant contact one with another through regular visits and other ways. To serve and nurture the victims of war and injustice in all ways available to us through our ministries, our service to and protection of refugees, and generous ecumenical sharing of resources. To engage in educational and political actions to reverse the current U.S. policy in Central America based on the threat and use of armed force, and to oppose overt military interventions by all parties to the current conflict in Central America. To use all the instruments available to us to serve as agents of justice and reconciliation between Central America and the United States, promoting and facilitating where we can a process of peaceful negotiation which respects the rights of all the peoples involved to self-determination. To ensure that this covenant is disseminated, studied, and adopted by national, regional, and local church bodies. To develop a new pedagogical approach to the life, mission, and educational programs of our churches so that our peoples may better understand the profound implications of the structures of injustice in order that our witness may be more faithful and effective.
Okay.
To establish a network between individuals in the United States and Central America exchanging names in order that there will be direct contact on a continuous basis between those who sign the covenant along with other concerned Christians in the United States and Central America. To hold ourselves accountable, singly and jointly, to Christ, the living Lord of history, and to the churches of the Oikumene for the fulfillment of this covenant. In God's grace, we trust to fulfill this covenant. Amen.
Thank you, Pat. That's a lot of stuff. And at this point, I think we will open the session to discussion. Comments, questions? Do you have any at this point?
What was the reaction of President Reagan and the administration to the telegram?
None, as far as we know. We didn't get any response, really, that I know of.
That question then I think would raise an issue perhaps as to what extent an act of faith of our part might be, if we in fact believe in what the covenant states, to what extent an act of faith of ours might be to attempt to persuade our governmental leaders that we should be in fact more sensitive to those oppressive issues. So that I think that raises that whole question. My experience in Minnesota has been that the congresspersons of Minnesota have been very responsive to letters and calls on these issues. They have responded, given us fairly extensive responses, answers to them, not always in agreement, but there has been good dialogue. So my personal experience is that represents a fairly good way of acting on this particular issue. My letters and telegrams to the president have not been, to date anyway, responded to, but that might not be surprising. Are there any other experiences that people have with regard to that?
My congresspersons and senators from New York State, which is where I'm a voting member, have also been, they have sent me letters and we have been able to engage in some discussion of this. It is still true that letters to Congress people make a difference. I think, I know I went through a period of time where I didn't think that was true, but I am coming to a different conclusion now.
they do want to hear from people, and they will respond.
Do you know what kind of activity there may be in other states other than the 2 year old from what there's been? Either been letters, telegrams, meeting, going out?
Well, I know that in the group that I went to Central America with in June, a large number of people from that group were from the state of Iowa, especially around Des Moines. And there were several articles in the paper, and they were going to be meeting with their congressperson, and they were also deciding to work together on the upcoming congressional races to find out where each person who was planning to run for Congress stood on the issue of Central America and how U.S. policy should be in that region, to get that information made public and then to disseminate it to everyone as a part of the campaign. So I don't know whether this effort is taking place in other states.
And I am not terribly familiar with
it. There's nothing that's come out of a congressional group that would indicate that they're concerned or that they're active in any way.
Out of Congress?
In Congress.
Oh, I think on the contrary. I think our Congress has been quite in accord with the fact that we should restrict covert actions. In fact, the Bolin Amendment, which was passed in 1982, specifically prohibited the administration from covert action intended to overthrow the Nicaraguan government. I think our Congress has been very, at least the House of Representatives.
By covert action, you mean distributing of arms, of loans, of...
The arming and military assistance provided to the counter-revolutionaries in Nicaragua for the purpose of overthrowing the Nicaraguan government. That Bolin Amendment is very, very clear, and it's well articulated. Now, our foreign policy has been that we are supporting them in order to restrict the arms flow into El Salvador. And it's on that basis that we are taking the covert action. I hasten to point out, however, that that has dried up, even according to our diplomatic sources. And at this point, it is my belief, contention, that the covert support of the counter-revolutionaries in Nicaragua is in violation of United States law. That is the Bolin Amendment. And I personally am offended by that. Incidentally, I want to make a statement here that there isn't an assumption that we all agree on this. This is our presentation, and you may or may not agree with this, and please comment if you don't. I don't want to make that assumption at all, because certainly this comes from where we are at this point in time. Question over here.
I've been studying the Central American situation. I'm rather confused as to what the United States is trying to accomplish down there. Are they trying to protect the country against communists? Or are they protecting big American interests? Just what is the situation?
Well, we have spent some time talking about that, and I think you've put your finger on two of the reasons for our policy, foreign policy in Nicaragua. And our discussions have gone something like this, that generally our perception in this country is that the crisis in that area is due to an East-West struggle. In fact, that the struggle between the Soviet Union / Cuba and the United States is focused in Nicaragua. And that if in fact we let Nicaragua go, which is clearly almost the case at this point, but El Salvador and Guatemala, that in fact we are then relinquishing that area to the Soviet bloc. The United States security will be endangered, economic interests will be endangered, and that in fact it will become a Marxist totalitarian state. That kind of thinking seems to be the basis for our policy.
I have a fellow worker that is a Yugoslavian. He was imprisoned for 6 months in a Yugoslavian prison under very bad conditions. He was caught, him and his family were caught trying to cross the water over to get into Greece, and they caught him and brought him back. But whenever this question comes up, he says, well, if we don't stop the communists in Central America, we'll be fighting them on American soil. Now, how are you going to answer a man like that? I mean, he's lived under conditions of the communists. He's been in their filthy, rotten prisons. And if it was up to him today, the United States of America would go right to war with Russia today and try to whip them, which, in my opinion, is an impossibility. But yet, you have to answer this man. How are you going to do it?
My response might be, in fact, if the Soviet Union were making Nicaragua its bastion, and I probably would agree with him. I'm very much in agreement that the Soviet type of totalitarianism must be stopped. But I think the point is that we hear over and over and over again from people coming back, say, from Nicaragua, is that is not taking place there. In fact, that what is taking place in Nicaragua represents a third alternative first of all, the Soviet type of totalitarian type of government, and secondly, the rather oppressive type of capitalistic supported government that the Somoza regime represented. Nicaragua presently, I think, represents a possible third alternative to that, and that is a democracy that has a mixed socialist, capitalist sort of economy, and one that in fact does provide for the poor and oppressed in that place. So my response to you is that I would concur, in fact, if the totalitarian communist movement that we see in the Soviet bloc were moving in there. I think the point is that it's highly questionable that that's happening. And I think that we raise that specter every time something seems to be upsetting the stability that we have had in place there in the forms of dictatorial military governments. I think that's always raised. You know it's always raised. We've lived in that. That would be my response to that.
Well, I really think it's our fault in the first place that those countries are in the situation they are. You probably know, and I think a lot of us know here, that the big American corporation, United Fruit Company for one, they've had vast, big plantations, banana plantations down there, and there are other big corporations. They have exploited those people. They've kept them under conditions of practically slavery. So I think we're pretty much responsible for what's happened down there.
I agree with you. I think if there weren't, in fact, I'm almost certain, if there weren't poverty in Central America, there wouldn't be rebellion there.
Communism strives on pitiful conditions like that. Yeah. They promise these people heaven on earth, and of course, these people not knowing any better, they fall for it, and pretty soon they're communists.
Good point. This is an interesting discussion. Let's try to get back on the track here of faith responses that we might have to the situation.
Yeah. I would just like to respond and say that I don't think that at least the people we talk to in Nicaragua are communists in the way that you were just using that term. They are Nicaraguans who have grown up in that situation and who take a lot of the impetus for their activity with the poor and the oppressed, first from Christian principles, because the country is so heavily Christian, and secondly, from the democratic principles of the United States. I mean, they have read and studied our American Revolution 200 years ago, and that is much of the strength of their own work. So I don't think that it's communism in the totalitarian Soviet Union sense that is leading that country right now. I think it's people with many other strong motivations.
Nicaragua wants democracy.
They do.
They want a democracy.
Sir?
Yeah.
You mentioned earlier in your explanation about that to treat hunger, it has to become political, and a response to it, and also treatment and medical and that in these countries, and our help to them. Do you mind elaborating more on that?
on why I think that they're political issues?
Right.
Well,
I have two different factions in my mind. I like to hear your.
Okay, I'll try to answer that as I understand your question. The reason that I stated that the hunger issues are political is that it isn't so clear to say that in this country helping someone to have more food is a political issue. We tend not to see it in that perspective. But in Central America, people who have gone into the poor places in Central America and have provided food has given cause for them to be killed. And that's why I say that sort of thing is a political issue. Getting killed tends to be kind of political. And I think we can see by focusing on that kind of issue in Central America that the matter of helping someone to have more food in that kind of condition, in fact, is a political issue. And to that extent, I think the Christian is called to do something political.
You could look at it two different ways.
I think that was part of the revolution of the Christian Church, the Roman Catholic Church that Dick responded to, was that nuns and priests who found themselves ministering to the needy in their parishes in the ordinary way that we would understand that, found themselves all of a sudden being confronted that their actions were political. And they were as startled as anybody else, because they were just doing what they felt their Christian faith called them to do. But they paid a very high price for it in many parts of South America.
I was wondering if there was any congressional representation at the WCC.
You mean people from the Congress?
Yeah, like Mark Hatfield, he's a fine Christian.
Well, the representation at the World Council of Churches, each church that's a member of the World Council elects from within its own membership the representative.
Could be a congressman.
So it could have been a congressman. I personally do not know of any. I know the people who were representatives from some of them from the American Lutheran Church and from the Lutheran Church in America, both of which had large delegations there. Catherine Koo, the former hostage in Iran, was a member of the ALC delegation to the World Council.
Any questions?
Are the Catholic and the Protestants working together?
In Central America?
Yes.
The history has been that it is highly Roman Catholic. Probably 90% of the Christians in Central America are Catholic. Some 10% are Protestant of the Christians in those places. The Protestant Church did not experience as radical a change as I described for you relative to the Catholic Church. In Nicaragua, the Protestant churches struggled with this, whether they should become involved in the revolution in that country, and finally did come to the realization that in fact they should be, and now they are to a considerable extent very much in support of the revolution in the Nicaraguan country. So my answer to you is that Protestants are of the same mind, but they have lagged a little bit behind the Catholic Church, which went through that very radical change, somewhat as a result of Vatican II. In fact, very much a result of Vatican II. So all Christians in Central America tend to be, with the exception of some groups, behind, say, the revolution in Nicaragua.
Well, our response has been both.
Yes.
All churches.
Yeah. We, the Lutheran Church now, which hasn't had a great deal of presence in Central America, has a person there, a good friend of ours, in fact, Phil Anderson, who is spending several months there looking at places and ways in which the Lutheran Church, at least, can have some presence there, can show solidarity with the people of that country. So at least I can speak from that particular perspective that things are happening, starting to happen with regard to the Protestant Church. Yes?
There's some of that in the covenant, sounds like it's a unilateral thing that we should withdraw. Is that true?
No. I don't think there was anything in the covenant that suggested that the United States should unilaterally withdraw. The language of the covenant was specifically discussed at this point in the meeting, that what we wanted was that all external parties to that conflict should withdraw. And that, in our understanding, means Soviet presence, if there is any, and Cuban presence, if there is any, as well as U.S. presence. What the primary emphasis of the covenant under the attempt to change the U.S. foreign policy is to move our own government away from primary focus on military engagement in that region to diplomatic engagement, to committing itself to work more fully with the Contadora group of Latin American nations and in the negotiation process with Nicaragua and El Salvador, rather than putting so much emphasis, as we are doing now, on military engagement.
I understand, though, that President Reagan has people working on the economic and social aspect, too. Isn't that true?
Yes, that is true. One of the questions that I would now know to raise, that I would not have known before I went to Central America, is to what ends are this economic and social effort being put? Are they supporting the military effort in Central America, or are they really supporting the attempt at reconstruction of the country so that everyone has a chance to benefit?
I think there is a real question about whether economic assistance of any magnitude will work alongside a military intimidation type of policy. I think that question needs to be raised critically, and I hope it is. And I hope that we can be a part of that critical analysis of what is happening. We're at the end of the hour. We need to get to the Vespers. Thank you very much for being here.